We need to, let's collaborate on this.
We'll call the, to order the House Committee on Business and Labor. Our first order of business this morning is organizational meeting and adoption of committee rules. I need to bang that again?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. So committee members, you received a copy of the committee rules, I think on Monday. They are identical to the rules from the 2011 session, except for one small change, which is in the timeframes for delivering amendments to committee staff on the minority report. Okay. That is it. Other than that, they're identical.
So the minority report is the only thing that
and
is that, different.
And it's just the time.
Obviously, it's time frame because our time frame is different. Mm-hmm. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, is there a motion? Chris, would you like to move for approval of the rules?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move we approve the rules.
Okay. Co-Chair Garrett recommends that we approve the rules. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Our first public hearing and there will not be a work session on this first bill, so our first public hearing is on House Bill 4035.
Thank you, Mr.
Staff
Chair.
Will please help us with a little orientation. Let's proceed.
See, this is familiar too because one of our three introduced committee bills. House Bill 4035 amends provisions of Oregon law to conform to changes in the Uniform Commercial Code, specifically Article 9, to clarify the meaning of the name of the debtor, to permit filing of an information statement, to adopt official filing forms, to specify the priority of competing secured claims, and to address related matters. The measure establishes an operative date of July 1st, 2013, and there's an emergency clause on the measure effective upon passage. We have no revenue impact, and we're waiting for the fiscal. They believe it's a no fiscal on that.
Okay, good. And do we have a witness list? It is the first day. It is the first day. And please, we always have a list, and if you wish to speak on an issue, please follow up and sign up on the list. Okay, let's start out Carl Bouger and anybody else that needs to come with this group. Let's go. Please give us your name, affiliation, and let's proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Lane Shetterly, I'm here really in two capacities today. One is as chair of the Oregon Law Commission, which has requested the introduction of House Bill 4035, and I want to thank you again for the committee's sponsorship of the introduction of the bill. This has been a product of the Oregon Law Commission, about a 9-month or so work group effort with bills circulating in draft for the past 6 weeks or a couple of months, and you have it before you today. The Oregon Law Commission was created by the 1997 legislature to engage in a regular and continuous program of law reform, and one of the sources of that law reform that the statute actually directs the Law Commission to look to is the Conference of Commissioners on Uniform State Laws, the National Uniform Law Commission, which is one of the drafters of the Uniform Commercial Code. Carl Bier, professor at Oregon Law, University of Oregon Law School, and I are both members of the National Conference as well, so that's my dual capacity here. One is chair of the Oregon Law Commission, and one is as a commissioner of the National Uniform Law Commission. Recommending to you adoption of House Bill 4035 to update Article 9 of the Uniform Commercial Code, which, as you heard in the summary, governs the filing of secured interests in personal property. I'm going to introduce Wendy Johnson just briefly to tell you what you have in the way of documents as part of the legislative record for this bill, and then I'll turn it over to Professor Bier to take you through the highlights. You've heard some of this already in your interim committee work, so we'll try and be brief about that.
Thank you.
And then I will just mention an issue about an alternative in the Uniform Act that has come up just in the last couple of days that will call for you to make a policy judgment when it comes time to moving the bill. But if I may, Mr. Chair, co-chairs, I'll turn it over to Wendy Johnson.
Okay, please introduce yourself.
Co-Chair Kinnamer, Co-Chair Garrett, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. I just want to get the paperwork right and the record right. Before you, you have a one-page summary of the bill that helps with carrying the bill and questions that may come up. You'll see on the left side of that summary is our letterhead with the list of our commissioners and our staff and our contact information, so that's helpful later as well. But this is just a summary of what this bill does substantively. Then you have a work group report that's also on letterhead that's entitled Keeping Secure Transaction Laws Effective. All of the commission bills traditionally come with an explanatory report that in detail spells out the sections, and that's what this report does. On page 3 of the report, there's a list of who participated on this work group, the attorneys and creditor folks and debtor type folks that all were involved, and that's listed in page 3 of the text. And then at the very end of the report, this one has an extensive appendix, and that's the official comments to the UCC Article 9. When the Uniform Commission writes its recommendations, they provide a detailed commentary, and we just want to get it on the record that this commentary was what the work group relied upon as well. And so the amendments that we're making, the reasons for them and their intended meaning, these comments should be of assistance as well, should our courts have to interpret what these provisions mean. So that's why you have the big packet. It needs to be a part of the legislative history to get that official commentary in. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, let's continue. Professor?
Co-Chair Kenner, Co-Chair Garrett, thank you for the opportunity to speak on HB 4035. I'm Carl Bier from the University of Oregon School of Law. I'd like to just briefly walk through the four principal substantive areas that the bill addresses. As Wendy Johnson mentioned, there are more minor statutory adjustments in the bill, and also in Appendix A, there are comments to the statutes that are important legislative history, so comments to the statutes that are being amended by the bill, as well as to statutory sections that are not. The first of the four areas that I would like to highlight for you has to do with the what's called the Article 9 filing system. It's a system of public records maintained by the Secretary of State's office, roughly analogous to the recordation system for mortgages. But of course, mortgages are real property. UCC Article 9 deals with the equivalent of mortgages on personal property. And the filing system is a way for lenders with security interests in collateral or equipment or whatever the personal property might be to give public notice of their security interests. This accomplishes two purposes. One is to protect the lender's rights in the event of bankruptcy of the borrower or a judicial lien, the execution of a judgment against the borrower. And the other is to give notice to prospective future lenders, future parties who are considering lending money to the same borrower can check the public system and determine whether they would be first in line or second in line, roughly equivalent to a first mortgage, second mortgage. So it's an important system. It's at the heart of Article 9, and the key of the system is the debtor's name. The Secretary of State's office indexes systems under indexes the filing of each creditor under the debtor's name, and prospective lenders search under that name. So it's important to have a certain amount of guidance on what the debtor's name is, and with individuals in particular, the law is in a state of pretty noticeable uncertainty. The current statutes nationwide provide simply that the debtor's individual name must be supplied. And when you reflect that there's no uniform law of names in this country, and that individuals can and do have multiple versions of names, or sometimes entirely different names, on their birth certificate, their driver's license, their passport, or informally the way they do business in the world, there's no particular basis for saying that one of those is or isn't the debtor's name. And the goal of the bill here is to lend some certainty to that area. I'll just mention, I saw in the newspaper the other day, a mayoral candidate in Eugene was born under one name, and in his teens was adopted by a father with a different name. And never changed his birth certificate. I don't know if he ever changed his driver's license, but he...
He did.
Okay.
He was also my opponent in the last
Okay, all right.
Small
stuff. Right.
Okay, thank you, Representative Boyle.
It highlights the fact that it's not unusual for individuals to have various names in various contexts. And that the current statute, simply calling for the individual name of the debtor, is not enough guidance when it's at the center of the system. So what HB 4035 does is provide some assurance to filers of financing statements that their financing statement will be effective to protect them in the event of bankruptcy or in the event of a execution of a judgment if they do one of three things. One is use the name on the current driver's license issued by Oregon. Or other identification card issued by Oregon. Two, if they use the last name and the first given name of the debtor. And three, it preserves the sort of vaguer option that we have in current law, namely the individual name of the debtor, whatever that might be. Not necessarily reflected in any particular document, but the way the debtor is known for conducting business purposes, for example. The first two of these options, that is to say the driver's license and the last name and first given name, give assurance to filers that their collateral will be protected. The third option, the individual name of the debtor, provides flexibility for the sake of non-professional lenders especially. The Article 9 system is used by any secured lender, whether professional or not. It's not intended to be an arcane and difficult system to maneuver, and so we are combining this provision of assurance with some flexibility for those who might need it. Moving to the second issue, it's related to the first. This is the debtor's name if the borrower is an organization, in particular what we call a registered organization. That's a corporation or an LLC or a limited partnership or the like, which is formed by the filing of documents with the Secretary of State, a certificate of incorporation, certificate of limited partnership, etc. And the bill clarifies that the name to use on a financing statement when extending a secured loan to a debtor like this is the name that appears on the documents that were submitted to form the corporation. The way the current statutes work, it's ambiguous. There's not a, the intent has always been to refer to these documents, but the statute frankly doesn't express it very well. And what the bill does is add a new defined term, public organic record, which is defined as being the certificate of incorporation or analogous birth certificate, if you will, for the organization. And then briefly, the other two issues hang together on their own. I'm referring to these as reliability of collateral in cross-border situations. There are two different kinds of cross-border situations, and Article 9 is careful to deal with these. A debtor may move from one jurisdiction to another. An Oregon resident may move to Washington or vice versa. An organization may move its chief executive office from one state to another. And all of this while the secured loan is outstanding. When the debtor moves, the governing law changes. It would change from Oregon's version of Article 9 to, say, Washington's version of Article 9. And prospective searchers or prospective lenders who are searching for whether there's been an encumbrance already would be searching in the new state. Article 9 provides a grace period to allow for these transitions. It allows for an existing secured lender to remain perfected under the law of the old state for a limited time after the move. During that limited time, the lender in the old state is expected to discover the move and take steps under the new state's law to perfect the secured interest there. They're given some time to do that so they don't have to constantly harass their debtor and waste resources asking, did you move today? Did you move today? And in these cross-border situations, what's missing under current law is a grace period for turnover collateral. That's to say inventory, especially accounts receivable is another example. But inventory is the clearest example. By its nature, inventory is constantly being sold and replaced. And the current grace period doesn't adequately address the replacement inventory. If the existing inventory is sold, that's gone as collateral. Replacement inventory is acquired and the secured lender is relying on it, but if it's acquired in the new state during the grace period, the secured lender under current law isn't protected, and what we're doing here is filling that gap. So that's when the debtor moves. The issue is almost exactly the same in the analogous situation of a merger, and I won't belabor it. I'll just point out it's slightly different from a move. An Oregon corporation merging into a Washington corporation isn't really moving. It's becoming a new entity, and so the theoretical background is a little different, but the concern is exactly the same. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chairs, if I may, just briefly, now that you've heard the overview, I want to add a little bit of drama to the hearing. I thought that might be interesting to you.
Before you proceed with that, and I think it would be fun to have some fun. That's a prayer. I have some poor choice of
words. I didn't
say
fun.
It shall be interesting to have some drama. But I guess if this has been characterized previously as primarily technical, and I just wanted to kind of reconfirm that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, it is technical with one dramatic element.
Okay. and let's proceed with that.
If you'd care to look on page 72, page 73 of the Uniform Law, the National Uniform Law Commission comments, you will see that with respect to the name of an individual debtor, and as Professor Bierre said, this is all about the name of the debtor. The Uniform Law Commission actually offers the states two alternatives. One alternative, alternative A, says that the name that we use for the purpose of filing and for the purpose of searching financing statements is the name on the individual's driver's license, if that individual has a driver's license. Otherwise, if they do not have an driver's license, then the individual name of the or the surname and first personal name. So if there's a driver's license, that driver's license name must be used for the purpose of filing a financing statement under this act in order for that interest to be perfected and secured against future lien holders. And it creates a very narrowly defined but also very precise definition of that name of the debtor. For anyone who has a driver's license, it's the name on the driver's license. Alternative B, which is the bottom of page 73, is what the Law Commission, your Oregon Law Commission work group, adopted, and that is a less strict definition of the name of the individual debtor that includes just the individual name, which is not a technical definition, just what name do they use, or the surname and first personal name, or the name on the driver's license. So it's a broader categorization of what satisfies the definition of an individual debtor. This was a choice that the work group had to make in recommending the bill to you today, because coming out of the National Uniform Law Commission, these were presented as alternatives. If you look on page 8 of the Oregon Law Commission report that you got today, it says at the very top, and now I blush, the work group's recommendation on this issue is unanimous. That statement was true when this report was written, or so we understood, because the Law Commission work group selected alternative B, which is the less precise, the more general approach to the name of the individual debtor for the purpose of these financing statements. At the conclusion of the work group's two or three meetings, I forget, the decision was made. I asked as chair if there were any objections. There were no objections, and so it went as the recommendation of the work group. It also went that way to the Oregon Law Commission, which met in full last week to review the bill and unanimously approved it. I learned a couple of days ago now that, in fact, the Oregon Bankers Association has disapproved the selection of alternative alternative B and would prefer alternative A, which is that name on the driver's license, the more precise. So I just want to raise that for you as a policy issue that you are going to have to make after all. We thought we had made that for you, but you're going to have to grapple with it. I don't want to take much time on it today. I know you're not going to be moving the bill, but I would call your attention to page 8 of the report, which really discusses the conversation of the work group in terms of how we got to alternative B, as opposed to alternative A. And this really was a very central focus because it's one of the few places in the Act where we had to make a decision to recommend to you. And there are several reasons listed on those pages. One just being the reliability of the driver's license, the fact that in the main text, if Alice maiden name gets a driver's license in that name and then gets married and does business and carries on in the other name, a credit manager at a small credit agency, not everybody is involved in Article 9, comes from a major bank with sophisticated credit departments, somebody may not know to go behind that name that person is using and say, I need to see your driver's license. So there was a risk there that we certainly do achieve certainty and clarity by focusing on the driver's license, but it's also a very small target. And the concern was that not every creditor and every lender and every business person who extends credit and takes these kind of financing statements is likely to have the sophistication in their through their staff that deals with these things to know that and hit that target every time. Other issues are mentioned in footnote 14 there that we considered. One is, as I mentioned, that small filers may not know to follow the stricter rule. Also, the fact that it's not a burden to check if you ask a debtor or a prospective debtor, what are your names? What are the names you use? You can run those names through the Secretary of State's database. It's almost instantaneous. And you actually have the flexibility to search different versions of that person's name. That's what happens largely today. Also an important point that when banks or lenders are concerned about their status as having a security interest in a debtor's personal property, they're not just concerned about other Article 9 security interest filings. There are federal tax liens out there that they are going to need to look for, and those federal tax liens are not going to be filed under that person's driver's license name. So those lenders are still going to have to search under other versions of that person's name anyway. And so the idea that alternative A provides this strict rule of certainty is really illusory in the real world when it comes to it.
Mr. Shetterly,
yes.
We are on a very abbreviated timeline today. We will return to this issue because, as has been indicated, we will not be moving the bill today as was originally anticipated. We will hear from Mr. Cosgrove in a few moments. I didn't mean to completely terminate your comments, but if we're not careful, we'll not get to our second bill.
Mr. Chair, I am sensitive to your concerns up there, being nervous with the gavel in your hand. So I will stop with that, but I would commend to you the discussion of that page of the report that discusses this very explicitly as to how we got to alternative B. I would say that as a uniform law, it will be uniform under alternative A or B, but certainly the Oregon Law Commission's recommendation was a strong preference for alternative B. Thank you very much. Unless there are questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Mr. Cosgrove.
Mr. Chair, Paul Cosgrove representing the Oregon Bankers and also John Deere Financial here on two issues, and I'll be very brief. The first one has been outlined by Mr. Shetterly, and I'd just like to compliment him and the other members of the Commission, including Representative Garrett, for the hours and hours and hours they put into this and other similar projects to improve Oregon law. The issue has to do with the individual's name, and Mr. Shetterly talked about the two alternatives. The reason that bankers in this state, along with other creditors, who are making business loans, and this is primarily a business loan issue. Rarely do UCC filings, a lot less common than they used to be, rarely now are UCC filings involved in consumer loans. It's almost all business loans. And why business creditors prefer alternative A is partly reflected in what other states have done. All 50 states are intending to pass this act to be effective next July 1st, 2013. 9 have done so far. Of those, 7 have picked alternative A and 2 have picked alternative B. So the majority of states are picking A. And they're doing that because it's not only a benefit to people who are filing, you know what name to use on the filing, it is a benefit. It's not perfect and it won't catch every confusion. It is a benefit to people who are searching. There are 2 states that have picked B. One is to our north, Washington, and one is Connecticut. But we know that the chair of the House Judiciary Committee in Washington is already committed to the industry. He has second thoughts about that choice and expects next session in Washington, not their short session, but their regular session, to re-examine that target. We think that if we go with A, we're likely to be in the majority and the most uniform choice in this uniform act. So that's a quick thing. Briefly, on behalf of John Deere, several weeks ago I was working with Professor Pierre and Mr. Shetterly on an issue that is related to Article 9, because if you are a motor vehicle or something that has a title, you don't perfect on one of these financing statements. You perfect by noting it on the certificate of title. And Oregon has a very broad definition of what is a vehicle, and then it has exceptions. These kinds of vehicles don't have to have titles. The things you might consider obvious don't have to have titles are farm tractors, a variety of things like that. Those exceptions have been built up over time and they're not very clear. People like John Deere Financial, who finance lawn, garden, construction, farming, and forestry equipment, are brought forth a proposal to clarify the exceptions of the Motor Vehicle Code so we know, is it a title or is it a UCC financing statement, and have a relatively bright line. We've reached agreement with all the parties in principle on that one. We are maybe still a few hours away from reaching technical agreement on the exact language. And that issue could be resolved on the other side. I've made the commitment to the commission. I didn't want that issue to hold up the bill. But I think we actually may reach agreement on that today, on the technical language that informs the agreement in principle, and hopefully we can have that ready for you too when you take this bill back up. With that, I'm happy to answer questions about either of those topics.
Great. Chair Garrett.
Thank you. I two questions, Paul. One's substantive and one's process. It's on your first issue. So if I understand it correctly, which, although I'm a commissioner, I did not work on this at all, so don't assume I understand any of it. The alternative the work group chose is more favorable to those who are filing because they have more flexibility. You're advocating the other alternative because it's, I guess, better for those who are searching?
Mr. Co-Chair and Mr. Co-Chair, I don't know that the first alternative is better for filers than the both of them, I think, are equally easy to implement for filers. I think the alternative A is better for people who are searching because there will be fewer occasions where they will be searching under a name and missing a filing. There will never be no occasions, and Mr. Shetterly pointed out one. If you change from a maiden name to a married name and your driver's license changes, and if you're looking at new driver's license, you're going to have to know that and search under old driver's license name as well, because it could have been filed under the old name. So there's never a perfect system. We think this is a better system. Both systems are improvement against the current one, where there's no guidance at all for anybody, but we think A is just significantly better than B. I'm not sure that answers your question.
That's helpful. So my other question is, when did the Bankers Association conclude that this is a problem with the bill? And it's really a process question, because I know how the Law Commission works. They go to great lengths to form consensus on issues, and they tend not to bring bills until they've reached it. And it sounds like they were quite surprised to hear that those who had been involved in the work group process now oppose part of the bill. So can you shed light on that?
Yes, I'd be happy to. And I apologize for the lateness in which we brought this back to the Commission. I think it's fair to say that everyone knew this was an issue from the beginning, but we didn't voice from the bankers' perspectives our concerns at the right level at the right time. I have one excuse. During the last meeting in which this issue was decided, I was sitting in this chair next door at a 3.5-hour Friday afternoon meeting on real property issues rather than on personal property issues. So I missed the last meeting, but that's not an excuse. There were other representatives of the bankers who could have been there and should have been there and were not there. So I think it's been known that this is an issue across the country as it's been debated at every single legislature. I think we should have made our concerns known earlier, and I apologize for that.
I think Representative Carr.
Paul, under option A, the more narrowly defined, what would be the consequence if a lender didn't get it exactly right, didn't get the driver's license name exactly right, and subsequently another lender came along, now they're searching for exactly the, you know, letter for letter. And I'm talking about transpositions, you know, adding a middle initial, whatever. Not the marriage example, because I think everyone understands that. What would be the consequence to the first lender?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, and if the professor would like to correct me if I misstate the consequence, please do. Right now, in all cases, you have that particular problem. Oregon system, if you're looking in the Oregon system, is particularly good about giving you sort of close but not quite the right thing that you're searching for results when you're doing your searching. In Oregon, it's less of a problem than in other states. In other states, if you're off by just a tiny amount, either under the old system on a B or an A, you could lose in a later bankruptcy or to another creditor. And that is one of the reasons why, if you have identified if there's a particular document, you use that document. Just like in the corporate context, it's the corporate originating document. That's the only one that matters. You have to get that right. If you don't get it right, you could lose your priority of your security interest in both circumstances.
So, follow-up question.
I'm just not sure I understood that. So I understand the current system and the fact that the system, the Secretary of State's database, will return anything like it, which is
more or less
anything like it. My question was, if we pass this bill, what will be the consequence to the initial lender, whether the Secretary of State system returns something like it or not? What will be the enforceability of the initial lien if the name is not the same as on the driver's license?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Conger, first of all, with respect to the debtor, it always remains enforceable. The only thing that causes a problem is competing creditors or a bankruptcy trustee.
Right.
And under either version of this, if you fail to meet the requirements, whatever we specify they are, A or B, even slightly, and the second creditor fulfills those requirements, they win. It's the same kind of thing when you're recording in real estate property records. If you somehow screw up on the property description and it doesn't get indexed right, you will lose to the person who didn't.
Thank you. Any further questions or comments? Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
I believe this concludes our hearing. My anticipation is we are awaiting some amendments, and we would anticipate scheduling probably a work session or instead of a public hearing, Mr. Chair, Co-Chair. Probably we'll just do a work session to finalize this probably on Monday.
Mr. Chair, it just depends on when the language is ready and has been analyzed by Fiscal and Revenue.
Okay, so with those caveats, we'll schedule it at our first reasonable opportunity. Thank you all for coming. And with that, we'll close the hearing on House Bill 4035. With that, we will now open the hearing on House Bill 4034.
Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 4034 changes the applicable interest rate for a contract's failure to make a timely payment in accordance with the public improvement contract to 9% per annum. The measure also requires a public improvement contract to include clauses that require contractors provide a first-year contractor with a standard form that can be used as an application for payment or as another method to claim a payment that is due to the contractor, and for the contractor to use the same form and regular administrative procedures for processing the payments during the subcompressed term. The measure also permits the contractor to change the form or administrative procedure if the subcontractor is notified of the new or changed form or procedure and a copy of the changes have been provided to the subcontractor. There is an operative date of 91 days after the measure's effective date and an emergency clause effective upon passage. And committee members, on your preliminary staff measure summary, it states that there is no fiscal revenue impact available. I just received the materials before we started. There is no revenue or fiscal impact on this measure.
Thank you very much. Any questions at this point? We have, I believe, six people to testify, and we have about 10 to 15 minutes before we have to clear the room because there is a subsequent one. I would ask, if possible, people be quick. My understanding is there is consensus about the bill, and people are coming to testify to that fact, in which case we might even be able to move the bill out because it's posted for a possible work session. So I'm not sure who the first three folks would be. Let's bring them, and then we'll have a second group, and then we should be ready to see. And if you can make your comments briefly and to the point, please introduce yourselves.
Mr. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sean Miller, I'm here today on behalf of the Associated Builders and Contractors and the Independent Electrical Contractors in support of House Bill 4034. You did hear this bill during the interim, during your interim agenda in January, so we won't repeat this, but it is a good bill for the construction industry to speed up payments in the construction industry and keep the flow of money moving, which is something that we really need to change in this economy. So again, we support the bill, and I'll turn the lid over to Dave Coots with Paragon Tile.
Hello, Mr. Co-Chairs and Committee. I just want to come here and...
Please give us your name.
Oh, thought he did. Dave Coots from Paragon Tile.
You got to do it yourself.
Okay. I just want to show our support for this bill. Thank you very much for working on it, and on behalf of a lot of the subcontractors, it makes a lot of sense, and we appreciate your efforts in putting it together.
Mr. Co-Chairs, members of the committee, John Rakowitz with Associated General Contractors. We're very pleased to be here in support of this bill. No secret, our industry is suffering. We had a lot of disagreements in 2011. Post-session, we came together as an industry, said what can we all agree to that works for all parts of the industry. The result of those discussions is this bill. I would point out this raises what the current rate on late prompt payment interest rate from a 2.25 to 9%. That's real money, a real incentive, and may not be a big bill, but it's definitely an important industry bill. Happy to answer any questions.
Any questions? Representative Esquivel.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe I missed it. In the bill itself, but what happens in a situation of where I say to my subs or providers of material, I want that by the end of the month, I pay out the 10th of every month, and I want it by the end of the previous month. They don't do their work. It comes in, say, the 2nd or the 3rd, which doesn't mean that it'll get paid on the 10th, and then you're over a 30-day period.
I can attempt it. John Rakowitz, Mr. Co-Chairs, and Representative Esquivel. What the attempt in this bill is to do is to avoid that situation as often as possible. First, you have expressly called out that in the contracts there will be forms that you must complete.
That's part of the forms?
It's actually in the forms. We're actually putting the forms in there to ensure that there are not games being played. I think Representative Johnson's nodding his head here. Secondly, you have to do that 45 days in advance. Mm-hmm. That gives anybody time to figure out what the forms are, the requirement, meet the requirements to be able to expect your payment within 30 days. So we think we've done that. Both the 45 days notice as well as the forms, and we tried to get at the procedures in this bill. Mm-hmm. That answers your question.
Very good.
Any further questions? Thank you, and thank you for good work.
Yep.
Yeah. Brian Cribb, Mark Burnson, and John Bullis, I believe. And is there anyone else wishing to testify on this bill today?
Co-Chair Kinnemer, Co-Chair Garrett, for the record, my name is Brian Krieg. I'm here today on behalf of the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning Contractors National Association, the Plumbing Mechanical Contractors Association, the workers of Sheet Metal Local 16, and for one day only, the Plumbing, Heating, Cooling Contractors Association. We're able to make it with the schedule going on today. About 10 years ago, I was the person who actually wrote the first bill draft for what what became the Prompt Pay Act. Over the last decade, we've seen some changes in things that are happening in the economy and in the construction field. This bill simply gets at a couple of key items that need to have some change to move forward. The old penalty system just doesn't work with current finances, and it was actually very convoluted to actually figure out what the penalty was. So this cleans that up, and then also then with the issue of the forms, making sure that we have direct deadlines on when they need to be out, and that if a form or a process changes, that the subcontractors have a chance to respond to that and not be caught in a paperwork trap. So this is a great bill. Our industries work together on this, as you heard, and really urge your support for this. This will be a help out there to the folks working in the field.
Thank you, Mr. Greg.
Please.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and committee. My name is Mark Burnson, and I represent the National Electrical Contractors Association for Oregon. And very briefly, I want to speak in support of the bill, and there's not much else I can add. I think it's very important legislation for the subcontractors, and in this day and age, they can't afford to be a lending institution or have their payments held up. And I would ask you to support us in Bill 4034. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, John.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Kenmer, Co-Chair Garrett, members of the committee. My name is John Molis. I represent the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. Our members work for the signatory contractors that these gentlemen represent, and I just wanted to go on record that our council fully supports this bill. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Any questions, comments?
Okay, we thank you. And instantly, I think the co-chairs and the committee thank you all. This has been a contentious issue, and raising it from 2.25% to 9% is a big issue. And getting out of what was kind of a catch-22, where if you played the game right, you could defer for a very long time, legally of sorts. It was kind of immoral, but legal, and it's nice to get this cleaned up, and we thank you. Any other comments or questions? We will close the hearing on House Bill 4034. We have a few moments left. Is there an interest in moving to a work session on said bill?
Let's do it.
Sure thing.
Let's do it.
Thank you. Would you repeat that loudly? And are we getting that on transcript?
You're the boss for the next 5 minutes. and this doesn't follow.
I was starting to like. I was liking the sound of it, but I guess.
Your wife. That doesn't apply when you're back in your office.
Well, that's true. And we all know that.
No, it doesn't apply in mine.
With that, let's open a work session on House Bill 4034.
Mr. Co-Chair?
Mr. Co-Chair, I move that House Bill 4034 be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Chair Garrett has moved that we move House Bill 4034 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Johnson.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you. I just want to point out that I think this is a great example of the kind of quality legislation that can happen when we get all the stakeholders together, and I just want to applaud all the folks that have contributed to this, but none of us can wave a magic wand and fix the economy, but we can certainly help the process for those folks that are engaged in these projects who actually have work and are trying to be profitable and so forth. So I just want to applaud everybody that's had a part in this process. Good work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to your point, I've heard from several people, not all the pieces of the compromise were as palatable right. to individual members as other pieces, but the consensus is a very good thing. Yep. Anything further? Usually we do this. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Let's see, who is going to carry this bill?
I'll carry you.
What? Johnson.
Johnson should carry it.
Let's have Johnson, Representative Johnson, carry the bill. Okay, is there any further business to come before the business committee?
You don't have any those in Lane.
We have 1 minute left.
Yeah, but I'm not.
Anything else, Teresa?
No, except that as a committee, we just sent an email warning you we are meeting this Friday, so the agenda will be sent out by the next half hour or so. So stay tuned.
And we are working on scheduling. As you know, scheduling has to be completed by Monday afternoon. So at that point, we will have our further hearing agenda put together. With that, we've concluded our business and we are adjourned. Okay.